The only role I ever played to anyone's complete satisfaction was Warren on Martyr and Pesty. As the idealistic and dreamy boy intern to Gordon Pesty, that fulminating lawyer extraordinaire, I seemed to myself and to others to embody something. The show itself was avowedly dumb, and we all, writers, actors, network, critics, audience, we all flogged ourselves those days for our complicity in its runaway success, but I was the exception. I was unaccountably soulful. Or not I, but the character I played, Warren Zoom, born on the wrong side of the tracks, single child of glamorous, widowed mom, persistently seeking fatherly mentoring from the irate and disarmed Pesty. This Warren Zoom struck the viewer as possessing some quantity of life outside the cold frame of the screen, beyond the rigid limits of what shadow plays could be mounted within that half-hour frame in the usual attempt to placate, amuse, and sell what needed selling. Short novels, geared to teenage girls, were hurriedly commissioned by Ballantine Books, decorated with my face, and offered on drugstore and supermarket racks. At one point, I remember, I had the cover of TV Guide and People magazine in the same week. Everyone wanted to know or to be Warren Zoom, and I was he. This all evaporated rather extremely quickly. Now Warren Zoom and I have suffered a permanent rupture. We go our separate ways, he trapped in his rounds, ever youthful, pushed deeper and deeper into cable television's circles of hell, where I accidentally glimpse him from time to time and hurriedly surf away. Me, aging, but not too badly, playing these other roles in my life here in Manhattan, for which Warren floats the checks, an elegant arrangement of mutual support and indifference. Or no, that's not true. I do nothing nowadays to support Warren Zoom. I'd say he owes me everything, but I'm not sure he'd agree. I live in capital's capital, but I root against the Dow. I feel an instinctive lizard thrill on those days when it collapses. I know I'm meant to feel we're all in something together. I ought to feel sympathy for the money men, ashen and dim in aspect, forgetful, sleepy, never quite themselves anymore. Yet if I'm honest with myself, I'd like to see them stripped even of their fog-gray suits, reduced to suspenders and barrels, put out of their misery at last. Sometimes this Dow enmity of mine seems like the worst secret I could disclose. I don't. Though I do dwell among the money people, that's incidental to what I like about the Upper East Side and to the matter of why I rarely go anywhere else. The secret of this place is its quarantine from the boom and bust of Manhattan's trends and fashions. Maybe someday, if the rumors are true, they'll build a Second Avenue subway line and all of this will change. For now, what's here is entrenched and immutable. The shopping cart ladies and the fur ladies and the black cocktail dress girls, the praying, tie-loosened 23-year-old junior partners, the reverse-slumming off-duty policemen, none has to glance at the others and wonder whether this place rightly belongs to them or anyone. The resonances and layers here are mysterious without being unduly impressed with themselves. Money has been here so long, it's a little decrepit. If one of money's laws is that it can never buy taste, here is where it went after it failed, and here is what it bought instead.